Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Night Shadows. I'm Stuart Best, where the paranormal is normal, where that which you thought you knew, you didn't. And where the future can be known if you know exactly where to look.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in and listening. We're very fortunate to have Richard Shaw with us tonight. Got a lot to talk about, a lot of news out there. We also have Larry on board. Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Well, hi. Thanks, guys, for having me on.
Oh, no problem. And Larry, how are you doing tonight up on the mountainside?
Oh, it's just raining like crazy and cold. Thanks for having me. And Richard, glad you're with us.
Yeah, where do we want to start tonight? There's an awful lot out there. I was thinking that possibly, and I'd like some comments from both of you guys on this, and it concerns the blood of Christ. And I don't know if you're all aware of it or not, but the Shroud of Turin, some scientists, you probably heard early on that it was proven to be a fake, or at least not the dating that it was supposed to be. I think it was dated around 1300 or so. But then some scientists got together because they found that one of the pieces of cloth that they had cut had been modified and had been mended, I guess one could say. So anyway, then when they went back, they found blood where it should have been if this in truth was the burial shroud of the Lord. Well, anyway, Harvard University and a few others did some research on the blood. And let's just put it this way. It is not human. And this is why I wanted Richard to really comment on this, because he's done some DNA work. The chromosome count for a normal human is 23Y and 23X for a total of 46, both the woman and the male joined together, and they form a 46 child. The chromosome count found by the universities and scientists that have run this is only 24 for the Lord Jesus Christ, the blood on the Shroud of Turin. And 23 for Mary and one from God the Father. But what's interesting is the number 24, because it means priesthood. And this is kind of interesting. What would you think about that, Richard?
It's an interesting topic. I know that the carbon-14 dating was most likely falsified by the labs that did it at the time. That is actually, it's funny you should bring up the shroud, because I just finished re-editing that segment in The Best of Watchers, which we just recently released.
Yeah, I know you did some work on that.
Yeah, The Best of Watchers had two experts that LA interviewed, the Right Honorable Barry Schwartz, who was one of the Sturp photographers originally back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stayed up for like 72 hours or something and took thousands of pictures. And then Dame Isabel Piksek, who's a particle physicist and also a muralist, who lives near Echo Park in Los Angeles, had her own views of it, saying it was an event horizon that created the image on the shroud.
Yes.
That's all in The Best of Watchers. But as far as the blood, what you're saying, I hadn't heard that yet. I have heard about claims that the Ron Wyatt Foundation made when he said he discovered the Ark of the Covenant in 1982 underneath the Zedekiah Cave complex in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And on his deathbed confession, basically related the same chromosome numbers that you're telling me now. So that's kind of interesting. Now, Ron Wyatt's story, it sounds like such a tall tale, and yet he tells it in his deathbed confession. And it would be very odd for someone to, knowing that they're about to die, to make up a story like that.
Yes. I ran into a similar situation. Had nothing to do with the shroud or anything, but it was about a guy by the name of Gustave Whitehead. And Gustave Whitehead flew about 4 or 5 years before the Wright brothers ever flew. And there were people on their deathbed giving testimony that they indeed had witnessed. I witnessed him flying long before the Wright brothers. And so this is very, very interesting stuff. I wrote an article for the airline pilot concerning him, and there was a lady that had written a book long ago about Gustave Whitehead and how the Wright brothers went to the Smithsonian Institute, or whatever you want to call it, museum, and said, if you will say that we are the first to fly, then we'll give you all our models to hang up. And Gustave Whitehead, of course, was basically kind of an unknown. But this is how history gets all messed up. Far away from the creator's blood on a shroud and a 24 chromosomes. That is really something, I believe, very wonderful. What do you think?
Yeah, it would have to be done in a very scientific way and revealed that way. I think that for the scientific community to believe it, but
mm-hmm.
they should do it.
Oh, absolutely.
And the problem that we found doing, it's known as paleo DNA, when you're doing DNA research on extremely old remains, sometimes mummified remains. The problem we've had, you guys, is that we can often get mitochondria DNA, but not nuclear DNA. And nuclear DNA is from the father. And that's usually so weak that we can't ever get it. That's been a problem. So it's interesting that they were able to get nuclear DNA that you're telling me off of this blood sample. Actual blood might be different. But you know,
yeah.
of course, that the shroud was in a fire. I don't remember the date. I'd have to look it up. I thought it was in the 1500s or something. Might have been earlier. It was in a box, and the box melted and dripped on it, and it was folded inside this box. And so that's why there are these patterns in the shroud when it's unfolded, because it was burned through. So then there were some nuns, I believe, that patched it. And recently, it's in the last few years, they've removed all the patches and they scraped all the burned stuff away and they vacuumed it and steamed the wrinkles out of it. And now the shroud is something like 10 centimeters longer than it used to be. And the image on the shroud is much fainter after they had gone to that problem. So by vacuuming it, they removed a lot of forensic evidence that could have been found out about it.
Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be a very smart move on their part. Why would they do that? Obliterate the evidence?
I don't know. It is seemingly a lot of that desire to remove the shroud as a viable piece of evidence. And
mm-hmm.
you know, these labs. Barry Schwartz said that the labs were paid 1 million British pounds to disprove the shroud.
You know, you would think they'd want it just the opposite. I mean, I think humanity knows.
It's real.
Yeah, you would think so.
But it still goes down as they don't know how the image was on the shroud. It wasn't painted on. It wasn't drawn on. It's not like a chalk drawing or, you know, charcoal or anything like that. It was some kind of burst of energy that did it. And
which of course,
also
yeah.
What's interesting, also
yeah,
what's interesting about it is the shroud is like was folded over the body. So if this image through some sort of burst of energy was created on the front and back side of Christ's body, assuming that's who it is, then without getting crude here, if you're laying naked on a piece of fabric, then you know your butt cheeks are going to be squished because it's against the stone, and your back and your shoulder blades are going to get squished into it. And you're not going to get a very good impression, and that's not what it looks like. And the only way that could have happened is if the body was levitating at the time that this image was put on the shroud, because it's all, like, perfect on both sides.
Yeah. Well, that would
so there
be
was something...
that event horizon, right, that lady scientist was talking about.
Yeah, and also
that he was...
she pointed out, and this is something that I don't know why hardly anyone ever mentions, but there were some strange things happening in Jerusalem at the time, at this very moment. People came out of their graves and walked through the city, it said. I mean, it was really weird stuff that was going on, but that... there was something really powerful that happened. Of course, the Roman guards were, you know, blown off their pedestals that were guarding the thing. And, you know, the seal was destroyed. And also recently, I had conversations with Yehiel Zoellinger, who is one of the archaeologists that has been with the IAA, the Israel Antiquities Authority, for 26 years, who has done a lot of research at the Garden Tomb, where we believe all this took place. There's more than one tomb, but they think this is it, that this is where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wall of the tomb, in front of where the opening is where the round stone had, you know, was rolled into position.
Right.
That there is a spike. I don't know if you know this. There's a metal spike in that stone wall, and there's a piece of it still in, you know, captured in the wall. And when you talk about this, it was sheared off by some force. So they said, well, you know, is this like a spike from Home Depot, or what kind of metal is this? So they did metallurgy tests on it and discovered it was from the Roman era, the Roman period, 2,000 years old, because of the metallurgy test that they did, and that it would have taken 70 tons of shearing force to slice it the way it had been broken.
Wow.
Man, that's a lot of pressure.
Well, it's obvious that in the resurrection, I mean, Paul even says that we have to be changed because flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven. So obviously then there has to be some form of energy shift, and that would make the cloth, when that thing happened, when the energy came to resurrect him, the cloth would have fallen down through or both ways. I think that lady scientist said they actually met in the middle as he rose
well,
up.
Well, she said there was some kind of a plane of energy between the front and back sides of the body, that there were like two events going on, one that did the front side and one that did the back side, and they're both like independent of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it you know, there's no physical explanation for it, but
no.
It's not a painting and it's not a drawing and it wasn't done by the hand of a man. So it's still, you know, it's an incredible piece of evidence of something that happened at the Garden Tomb.
Yeah. Larry, what do you think about it all? I mean, when I first saw the picture of the shroud, I had taken a picture of the picture, took it into a dark room, and made enlargements. And that was just amazing. And I just, spiritually, I felt, this is really the Lord himself. This is a picture of our Savior. I just felt it. I had no, you know, you have no particular proof, but I think they're getting there. Harvard University's done a lot of work on it, I guess, and some other scientists have done. And now they've proven that the radio carbon dating was wrong, and it is about where it was supposed to be. And then they found pollen, I understand, from that era of time in Jerusalem. So there are a number of proofs that this thing clearly could be, without doubt, the shroud, the burial shroud. What do you think?
Yeah, I was thinking about what you and Richard were talking about as far as the forensics being clean. And, you know, I was in law enforcement for years, and one of the things you do not do with any piece of cloth or anything else that has residue or evidence on it as far as forensics is you never clean it. You absolutely never clean it. And, you know, you ask, well, wonder why they would do such a crazy thing. And the only answer that I can come up for the moment is the fact that, number one, you know, the event itself was religiously, politically incorrect. I mean, you know, Sanhedrin of the day could not have a living Jesus up and moving around. Or they, you know, they actually, you know, if you watch the movies about Jesus, you know, they really searched diligently after he rose for that body. They had to have a body. I mean, they, you know, they. You know, it couldn't be a resurrection, you know, and with the body missing, we had no explanation for the people to show that it did not occur. So it was a quandary. But on the other hand also, you wonder, you know, anything, a lot of stuff with the Smithsonian and universities and other groups of people, and we know who run those things, is, number one, today, in the day we live, you know, actually a shroud of Turin and the Savior or the event and all the revealing data would actually be so politically correct. If you look at Psalm 2, they couldn't allow it to be examined. They could never allow the results to be shown. And we're back to Psalm 2 again, a war against the Lord and his anointed.
Yeah. There's absolute proof that humanity has fallen and they hate Jesus Christ. And it's like the UN hating Israel. It's spiritual in its nature. And they just can't get away from it.
Yeah. I agree with that. Just like their comments about Jerusalem are so ridiculous. Everyone knows that the Jewish homeland, it makes no sense at all. And, you know, the Knesset is there, the Jerusalem Museum is there. I mean, all of these things. And then all of the, that was another thing that I wanted to mention is the huge ongoing search for artifacts, stunning developments that are going on right now under Jerusalem that I've been privy to in the past year are really unbelievable and undeniable that this was the place where everything happened that scriptures talk about. I mean, they're finding all sorts of proof of ancient structures underneath parts of the Temple Mount. They just found another portion of the Western Wall. They found a Roman theater underground. They're beginning to discover drainage, flood control systems that stretch all the way from Silwan, apparently clear underneath Jerusalem. They're now just really understanding how the city's being put together. And there was an Arab guy who is, this is a story that we'll hopefully get to reveal this coming year, but there was an Arab man who has a store in the Jerusalem market. He's had it for decades. It's been in his family, and he wanted to expand it and put a restaurant in. And so he knocked out the back wall, and he did it at night, pulling out mountains of dirt in like a bobcat kind of deal, and it ended up on the Jerusalem police surveillance cameras. And all his stuff was coming out of his face. So the IAA went down there to say he's doing an unauthorized excavation, and he had discovered an ancient room behind his normal space that was basically from the Crusader period. I mean, it was like archways and crosses embedded in the ceiling and stonework, and it was all completely intact and looked like new.
Wow.
And you'd be able to sit in there and, you know, feel what it was like during, you know, 1200 AD, during the Crusader period, and eat in there. And he ran power and hung some lights up there. And then when I was there, he opened up a trap door in the floor. And he said, then there's more down here. And so we're all crawling around under his building. And under there were more rooms that were not fully excavated that had archways and more Crusader stuff. We don't even know what all is under there. But now we have pretty much believe that there's some 18 tunnels crisscrossing underneath the city of Jerusalem.
Interesting number.
All of this is starting to come to light. Yeah.
One more thing on blood.
And legend...
Go ahead.
Yeah,
finish up that.
Legend has it that there is a tunnel that is super long that stretches all the way from Jerusalem to Jericho. This is something that you know, none of us have found it, and this kind of branches into the next topic, because I think what's happening right now is so incredible. And a lot of these things, guys, could be done if there was the budget to do them. Money is always has been the inhibiting factor of finding more truth and getting stuff done and doing more film work. And the stuff I love to do just happens to be expensive. It just is.
Yeah, very, I'm sure.
There's a growing need for money, and there's important projects that I want to do that are expensive, and they would help Israel, and they would help Israel's PR around the world. But in order to do that, you need distribution and production budgets, and these are fairly large, or nothing could be accomplished. So, you know, we have all the Arab nations in an uproar over Trump's decision to move the embassy. And then we've got, in the same vein with trying to raise funding, Larry, you sent me a link to the Jim Baker show, this Indian guy that came on and made a prediction that California is going to be destroyed by an earthquake. And people have been saying that literally for decades. And my father was ordained, didn't have his own church or anything, but he was a friend of a man back in the 70s and 60s and 70s by the name of Demas Shakarian.
I know all about Demas.
Well, my dad knew Demas Shakarian, always spoke very highly of him, and every time I heard him talk, he was a very kind-hearted, sweet guy. And he had some kind of a dream. I think Demas had a ranch or something. He had cattle or horses. I don't know. It's been too long. I was probably 9 years old when this happened. He had some sort of a dream that there was going to be this major earthquake, and it scared him half to death. And so he moved away. He moved his whole deal somewhere else. Now, I don't know where he moved it to or anything. I would have to research that and find out. I know that they actually built a building at ORU in memory of Demas Shakarian. So I think he knew Oral Roberts and those folks there and everything, whatever that means. But he was a good guy. I can attest to the fact that he was a serious, believer. And yet he was wrong. Demas has come and gone. He's already passed on, and there's been no major earthquake. Although there have been a couple smaller earthquakes. There was one in, I guess, 96, and one about 10 years earlier up north in the San Francisco area. Remember when that highway pancaked on itself and crushed a lot of people, and one of the bridges fell apart, and then 10 years later there was the Sylmar quake and some of the overpasses collapsed, and a motorcycle cop basically ended up in midair and died, and a lot of buildings suffered a lot of damage near Beverly Hills and areas like that. But it still wasn't the big one. It still wasn't like California slipped into the ocean or anything like that. And I know that there's a lot of people that would like to see that happen because they think that all of California is leftist, which is not true. Because I live here and I have to try to explain to some of my left-leaning friends why I believe the way I do, and they listen to me. So it's, you just do your best. But I don't think God, as the scriptures say, has given us a spirit of fear. And especially we're not supposed to use that to prey on people's fears to raise money for things. It just seems unfair to me to do that. So what has happened in the past few years is that when Iraq was, when they went to war in 2003, and in fact, even before that, the 91 Gulf War, they stole a lot of dinars. Saddam Hussein stole dinars from Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kuwait had to basically devalue their own currency so that Saddam Hussein couldn't spend it. So when the U.S. went in there and basically cleaned house with Saddam and won the war and all of that, about a month after it was declared that, the war was won and Kuwait had been freed and all that, they revalued their currency back up to where it had been before. And a lot of people became instant millionaires overnight because of that. They were holding this devalued currency, and it went back up to, 320 to the dollar or something. It was really highly valued currency, and it happened over a Sunday. Well, Iraq has been running on this old currency now for decades. And right now it's like something like 11.82 to the dollar. And they, over the past several weeks here, they've basically cleaned the country out of ISIS and recaptured Mosul and a lot of the desert areas that ISIS was still camping out in. And basically Abadi, who's now in charge of the country, declared that Iraq was now liberated. So a lot of people had been investing in Iraqi dinars thinking that that's going to happen again. And it still hasn't happened. And it's very difficult to understand why not, because they need money in the worst way, because they've got all of this war damage and into the billions of dollars where things are just in desperate straits. And they need to do it, and they still haven't done it. And yet we know that they have printed lower denomination bills. They've printed them in Europe, and the United States has minted lower denomination coins, which they call fill. And this stuff has been delivered. And I have friends that study all of this, and they have friends in D.C. that give them intel on what's going on over there. And still it hasn't happened. There's a guy who is a Christian man. He's known as Bruce. He does a call every Tuesday and Thursday about Iraq. It's called The Big Call, and he has thousands of people that listen to it. And every time he comes on, he says, well, we thought this would be our last call, that they're going to RV, like it's imminent, they're going to do it, and they never do it. And I talked to Bruce this week, and I said, Bruce, I listen to you quite often, and I said, you always tell me that it's going to happen, and then it never does. And I said, I believe you. I believe you when you say it's going to happen, because this guy has a good heart. I don't think he's there just to try to deceive people. I think he really thinks it's going to happen. But a lot of people thought that they were going to RV before Christmas. And we don't know yet. And some people thought that it was held up because they were waiting to see if Trump was going to sign this tax law. Huh. And he just signed that.
Yeah.
So it could be that they're waiting until 2018 rolls around to do it. or we don't know why they would wait after that. But meanwhile, while all that's going on and people's need for money is still increasing, what's happening right now with cryptocurrencies is really interesting. And the only reason I'm mentioning this, because I'm not like a person who is an economist or anything like that, but when something as weird as what's going on is happening, then I have to go, this seems really prophetic to me. I mean, what we're watching now could be the beginnings of how the mark is used and what how it works and the whole electronic aspects of it and all that. Are you with me, guys? You know what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah.
So I started doing some research. And what's interesting, my bank isn't far from our house. And I know the branch manager there really well, and we're good friends. And he loves watchers. It just really, really cracks me up. And he also believes in UFOs and aliens and all that. Of course, the New York Times this week came out with some footage from 2004 of an Air Force jet taking radar footage and chasing a UFO. And everybody saw that, right? And I guess it was on CNN as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that means anything. But, I mean, I look at it and go, well, yes, another UFO piece of video, which I see hundreds of. And now why NASA is releasing this one, you know, and I talked to L.A. about it, and I said it's like soft disclosure, you know, like they're just trying to gradually pull the veil away a little bit. But my banking friend is so into this stuff, that's why he loves watchers so much. He pulled his shirt back, and on his chest was a gray alien tattoo. And I go, you're kidding me. It wasn't real big. It was kind of little. He's totally into it. He thinks it's about to happen. He said, and he told me the other day, he said, do you realize what a time we're living in right now? You know, where if they reveal that, you know, aliens are among us and UFOs are real and we've got cryptocurrencies, and people are getting millionaires overnight. And I said, what do you think about all of that? And he said, it's going to put us out of business.
Huh.
That's what he said. The branch manager of this bank, I won't mention which bank it was or anything like that. And I said, well, you know, I said, Bitcoin has been really volatile. It's like up and down. I mean, I wish I'd have gotten in at the beginning of it. I mean, if you'd put $100 into Bitcoin back in, you know, 5 years ago, you'd be a millionaire today. And, of course, Bitcoin over just the past few hours lost a lot of its value. It went down to like $12,000 per Bitcoin and then went back up. Now it's back up close to $15,000 again. I mean, it's vacillating by thousands in a few hours. It's incredible.
Well,
and I don't know if anybody's following this, but it's the process that this is. It is fascinating because it's all using something called blockchain. And you guys have, I'm sure, heard of that.
Yep.
But the average person doesn't know what you're talking about when you say these things to them. And it all sounds just like fantasy. It's like, well, I'll believe it when everybody else is doing it. Well, then by then it's too late. You've missed the boat if you don't start studying this now. And I have a feeling that we have an opportunity to get into some of these things quickly. And my friend told me, he said, well, one of them that's really interesting right now is called Ripple. There's hundreds of cryptocurrencies available right now. But there's only a few that are hacker-proof, and a few that are actually becoming usable. And so you've got like Bitcoin Lite, and you've got, of course, Bitcoin, which is kind of like now so pricey, you know, one can afford it unless you get fractional amounts of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's Ethereum and Ripple. And Ripple is like a dollar. It's like, you know, it was a few cents, and it's already in 2 weeks, now it's up to over a dollar. So, I mean, these cryptocurrencies are expanding by thousands of percent in a six-month period. So if you invested $100 into one of these up-and-comers, within a year you could be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not telling people to spend their life savings and doing something like that, but it might be to say, well, you could take a chance on some of these and see what happens. So I've been studying what blockchain is, and it's basically a way, it was originally designed for Bitcoin, and it was a Japanese guy figured it out, and there's a company called Coinbase is the most popular method to access Bitcoin right now. And the way it works is you get on your iPhone or on your smartphone, you download a little app called Authy. It's like Authy. And Authy generates a token with a password code. And then you put that into Coinbase, and it lets you in to your account. And what this is all about is that the easiest explanation, in fact, that I read today, because I knew I was going to be on your show and try to explain this to people so they understand, with blockchain, it's like in the past, like say someone, especially if you've had legal stuff or non-disclosure agreements and you're sharing those documents between people, well, the way that that's been done in the past is it'd be generated in Microsoft Word and you'd email it. You'd wait for your friend to open it, look at it, make his changes, excuse me, send it back to you, and all that. But with blockchain, you can send it out there privately between how many parties need to see the document, and you can all work on it in real time, and the other guys can see your changes being made.
Uh-huh.
And yet none of the other computers are storing this information. It's all private, personal. It's hacker proof. It's basically it's an incredible way to do it. And so blockchain may also be something that's used for the internet to ensure security on purchases and Amazon, eBay. I mean, it's going to expand. There's going to be, you're going to hear about blockchain constantly in 2018. And what I've been advised of is that there's basically three phases to these early adapters to this kind of technology. There's the guys that get in, that take the risk, put a little bit of money into it, and then there's a surge of smart people that go, oh, this is interesting, I'm going to do it too. That's like level two. And all of a sudden the price goes up quite a bit. People that could have afforded it now can't afford it anymore. And then all of a sudden the general public gets wind of it, who hasn't studied any of this stuff and researched it, and then they go, oh, crap, now I've got to do this. So then that's level three, and all of a sudden the whole thing explodes. It gets massively expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And
like Bitcoin.
What I've been told is, like February, bondholders and large corporations and really wealthy people are getting ready to invest in these currencies. And once they do that, then it's kind of over, because everything will be so expensive. But if you get in early, you have a chance of really making some money. I'm talking like 1,000%, 5,000% return on your investment.
Let me ask you something real quick. This block deal you're talking about, the system, is that somehow involved AI or possibly quantum?
Well, I don't think it's even that. It's sophisticated, but I don't think it's AI. It's basically programming language that allows all of these servers to be interconnected, and it uses computer processing power, normal computers, and they're calling it Bitcoin mining. So, like, if you help with the processing, then you can earn Bitcoin through your computer. So people are setting up Bitcoin mining computer systems all over the world, and some of them are using up enormous power to do this. I mean, like, the numbers that I've been reading are just absolutely incredible. But what happened a couple of years ago, I don't know if you heard about the Mt. Gox meltdown, but there was a Bitcoin distributor called Mt. Gox. I think it's in Japan, and a hacker got in there, and a lot of Bitcoins that people owned disappeared, several million dollars. And so the price of Bitcoin at the time that happened was almost $1,000 for Bitcoin, and it plummeted to like $350. Well, at that point, I got to thinking, well, this isn't secure enough to invest in it. And a lot of people lost confidence in Bitcoin. But now, just this past few weeks, it's almost penetrated $20,000 per Bitcoin. It's insane what's been happening. Today, the last time I looked, it was $14,800 per Bitcoin. So imagine if a couple of years ago, if you'd have put in, you know, $10,000 into Bitcoin, you'd have, you know,
you'd be a billionaire.
An incredible amount of money. Yeah, and so that's what they're saying about Ripple. Because Ripple right now is like almost like penny stock. If you go into your piggy bank and get $100, you can't do any less than that. And it's not easy getting into Ripple. You have to go into CoinBank, and then you have to use Bitcoin to buy Ripple. That's what we've been seeing. And Coinbase basically halted all trades while Bitcoin stabilized yesterday because it was going, it was losing ground. It went down to 12,000, and now today it's back up almost to 15,000. So it's vacillated like $3,000 in a single day, which is just unbelievable. But we don't think that Bitcoin may necessarily be what to invest in, because we don't think that, I mean, it could go up further than that. I suppose it could, but it's gotten so pricey that people are looking for other alternatives. So, you know, Ripple seems to be a good one, and Ethereum is another good one. But Ethereum's gone up like crazy, too. It was like $100 or something. Now it's like $700. And these are going up fast, like in a 2 or 3 week period. So being that you have to have this token deal, I got to thinking, how could all this be used during the time of the Mark of the Beast that we all read about? And everybody's always wondering about that. And of course, if we weren't reading scripture, we wouldn't be thinking along those lines or wondering about what John was trying to tell us on the Isle of Patmos, because in really, quite honestly, some of it is so crazy. It's to an average person who doesn't realize the spiritual ramifications of what's going on, it just sounds like utter nonsense. But now we can see how, say, for example, say that the Mark of the Beast is a chip, which we've thought it now for quite some time. It's a chip that goes under your skin. But say that chip is your token for your cryptocurrency, and that all currency has become cryptocurrency, which could really happen in short order. Okay, good. We know that a lot of banks are no longer carrying paper currency anymore. It's all done electronically.
Yes.
And so I could really imagine that they would say, oh, this is such a hassle. You got to carry your smartphone or your Apple Watch or something to look up your token number so that you can get into your Bitcoin or whatever coin you've got account so you can make a purchase. And we think Amazon is going to go into this in a big way, and eBay and other huge mega companies are going to start using cryptocurrencies on a regular basis. And the way it's been explained to me is just like the internet, no one knew what a homepage was back in 1996. Now everyone has to have an internet site, a website, and everybody knows what it is, and businesses that don't have one are basically non-existent. And that's the way this is all going to be. It's going to happen just like that over a period of just a few years. It will become the norm. So what if the mark is your token to get into your cryptocurrency account? It makes so much sense to me when I thought of that. You know, you wave your hand over a computer and basically picks up your signal and it lets you in and you can buy or sell. Without that token number, you can't. You're locked out of your money.
Well, and with the advent of the G5 wave, I call it a G5 wave, the advanced technology on cell phones, the way they're collecting all the data, like silent weapons for quiet wars said they would do, they're getting data from everything you do, every keystroke you do on your computer. And it all goes into this kind of queen who is the artificial intelligence, and I think that's what Larry was getting at. And the artificial intelligence collects all of this data, then develops the profiles on everybody, and then you're actually a slave to the economic system, and you can't buy and you can't sell without this mark, which evidently they can track you with and probably do whatever they want with it. I don't remember if you remember the Bullock film. I can't remember what the name of it was, where they took everything she had. She was getting into something they didn't want her to know about. So they took away her credit cards. They took away everything. Took away her identity.
Yeah, that was
Sure.
That was Sandra Bullock in Sale, wasn't it?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, so, I remember that movie. I mean, it's almost like, you know, you can. That's what LifeLock is supposed to protect you from, is someone stealing your identity, because that is like, it's all electronic now. And then, of course, the iPhone 10 is using facial recognition to let you in, instead of using thumbprint passcode, to be able to lift the phone up and look at the phone. That's getting a little creepy. And then there was this thing that came out on TED Talk. You guys saw the killer drone video. I'm sure everybody, I mean, millions of people saw that video, right?
Yeah. Which one?
The killer drones, for, you know, these tiny little drones that they have. They're all on this particular demonstration. It was AI. I mean, the drones were controlling themselves, and they could slam into somebody's forehead and explode, and killing them instantly. And they were doing it through facial recognition software. So basically, this is AI controlling a tiny drone, and they could release them from a plane by the hundreds and basically fly into a war zone and just kill the bad people selectively. That's the way they're promoting it, but who determines who the bad people are?
And, well, that's the problem.
Say that they just they want to kill anyone that doesn't, that likes President Trump or something, you know. Then you've got like a whole deal where they could, you know, the powers that be could do that, the NSA or the CIA or whatever.
Well, it's very obvious, I think, that the vast majority of humanity will, in fact, accept the mark when it comes right down to it. When the rubber hits the road, or the, you know, that's when those kind of decisions are made. And we're getting awful close to that. I mean, they can slam the hammer down virtually overnight if they choose to. In fact, there is an economic guy who claims that that's exactly what they are going to do. They're going to throw a switch, and all the banking stops. Everything stops. Credit cards, debit cards, you can't do anything. You are where you are, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, it's
they can shut it down
overnight.
The
reality.
Go ahead.
Cryptocurrencies become the reality, then it would be easy to deny you access to it, because the blockchain would prevent it if you couldn't show your identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, and there's a lot of people saying that there's millions of dollars to be made right now, because any company that's investing in blockchain technology or coming up with things that promote that is going to get rich, because it's going to be a necessary thing for security. And we've had a lot of security issues this past year. I mean,
yes, we have.
My bank account was hacked, and somebody, most likely, I mean, they could do this. And I asked, how would they do this? Said, well, you'll go to a gas station, and you'll put your credit card in the pump, and your PIN number, and then you drive off, and then someone comes in and they have a device they can put in there and read that information back. So they have your name, your PIN, and everything. And then what they do, they have a machine that makes an actual credit card with all of that information, and they can put that into a machine and pull money out with it.
Wow. Well, you can see what the arguments are going to use.
yeah, this is what I'm saying. They would say that, you know, we've got too much fraud and all of that. And I had a great excuse because when this happened to me, I was at 38,000 feet on an LL flight headed for Tel Aviv. And that's when the money was withdrawn from my account.
Huh.
And it was like someplace in Milwaukee or something. It was like an exercise company that I'd never heard of withdrew $5,100 from my account fraudulently.
Did you get it back?
Yeah, finally did. The bank worked with me. I said, hey, guys, what's going on? A whole bunch of money just left my account. So I had to move all my money into another account to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was short money while I was overseas. It was scary.
Yeah.
The whole moral of the story is the only reason I'm talking about finances is because it has been the biggest impediment to forward progress this year of anything, because all of these projects are expensive, and if we really want to help Israel, it's expensive to do, and I want to figure out ways of making more money, and I don't want to, you know, ask people for money or anything like that. I just want to figure out a way to do it, and this may be a way that, you know, God is opening up to help people do that.
Things are moving at lightning speed, and definitely we're moving towards the mark, and I do believe this cryptocurrency is paving that way to a digital world. This is what they're trying to do, is make everything in a digital world and actually create an AI god.
Yeah, it's, you know, when they talked about these particle beam weapons, people said that they shot pictures of these lasers coming down out of the sky to set stuff on fire in California. I mean, but then when I looked at the pictures that they were sending out, it didn't look like that to me at all. But, you know, I kind of chuckled and I told L.A. and I said, well, you know, the scriptures say that the Antichrist character is supposed to be able to call down fire from heaven. Remember that?
Yes.
Like, none of those things. I mean, my whole thing, and I talked with Casper about this. Casper, really great guy, and he's totally into all this stuff too. And I said, you know, if you were living 2,000 years ago, and you were shown a vision of this kind of stuff happening, beams of light coming from space and doing stuff on the ground, how would you describe that? It would be fire from heaven, right? Wouldn't that be it? Because it's hot and it's setting stuff on fire, right? But now we understand these things. We understand that there's all kinds of black ops projects that are in the works, and there's incredible technologies that are kind of like gradually emerging that we're learning about. And so this stuff is no longer a mystery to us. In fact, this one beam where they have this parabolic dish and they put it out in the field and they can make people feel like they're real hot. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's just all directed. It's just an energy weapon, and it's just directing microwaves towards people that makes their skin feel hot. And none of this stuff is rocket science, really. I mean, when you think, it's just another way of using existing technology and making a weapon out of it. It's really all of it is. But the cool stuff is what's happening with the whole UFO phenomena and the back engineered craft that I do really indeed believe that we've done. I think that we've got that technology and have had it for a long time and are experimenting with it and using it now, and they're not telling us what they're doing with it. And we know that there's a space program and all of that going on, but we're not allowed to know about it. And I think Trump is trying to to end all the secrecy, which I thought was really cool that he came out with the JFK papers and told them to release those. And now
they're
finding out
old.
The most recent thing. Yeah, the most recent thing they discovered was J. Edgar Hoover was saying, you know, once Oswald had been killed, he said, well, that's it. We don't need to tell the American public anything more. That's enough for them to know.
Well, the arrogance.
Yeah. It's truly remarkable. And, you know, and then evidently the government in Cuba was monitoring the Dallas situation and knew it was going to happen that day. I mean, it's like it was a huge conspiracy, and now all this stuff is out and you can read it for yourself.
Yeah, and they withheld a lot of those papers still.
Yeah,
and
that's why
I think Trump acquiesced for a little while, but I think he's going to demand them. I think I read an article where he thought that, you know, why do they need to hide this stuff now on JFK?
Right. Well, they released a lot of it, and then they were going to wait and release some more, and I think they finally did release even more of it because Trump demanded it be released. And then, of course, he signed the tax thing into law today. I heard that, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the Democrats hate anything that Trump does. It wouldn't matter if he was giving money to the poor or, you know, saving unborn babies or anything like that. They would say it was terrible and this is the worst thing to happen to America. And I can't believe the stuff they say sometimes. It's just like, what? It's just incredible to me.
Well, with all the stuff going on and all of the portals that, well, Larry's living right by a portal, it seems like. And, you know, people are photographing this stuff where these little things open up and creatures are coming through. I mean, there's a Red Elk, who was a Native American elder, was big on saying that the veils are thinning and that the other dimensions are going to start to mesh with ours. What's your take on that? And Larry, too.
Oh, yeah. I think that's what's happening. I was looking at this image, Bob Williams, my special effects friend.
Mm-hmm.
He's often driving through the desert because he lives in Arizona and drives into Hollywood for work. And he just sent me a picture of a rocket in the sky over Mojave. And
really?
He's thinking it might be SpaceX.
Huh.
And I wrote him back, Edwards. It's probably Edwards because that's where they do stuff. But, I mean...
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, they would blow missiles up in space all the time, and you'd see the squiggly line way up high in the sky, and it would glow
mm-hmm.
at night because the sun would illuminate it. Even though it's nighttime, it was above the curvature of the Earth, so it was picking
mm-hmm.
up the rays of the sun and lighting it up, and it would be multicolors, and it would look really cool. Well, he just sent me a picture of something that looks similar to that right now. It just happened.
Hmm. Interesting. Larry, what's your take on all that? You live by one of those strange places.
Yeah, and where I'm at, too, there's an incredible amount of electromagnetic activity going on. Of course, I'm up high, kind of, for this part of the area, but it seems like a lot of people, you know, and you know people up here, Stuart, the friends of yours, that... there's a lot of anomalous activity going on, not only creatures, but objects and flashes of light and glitches and everything electronic. I mean, it is bizarre.
Wow.
Well, I think it's going to get a lot more bizarre.
I think so. I mean, if they start disclosing, and of course I've been writing Stephen Bassett, the D.C. lobbyist for disclosure, you know, and and I wrote him and I said, remember what I said about Trump not to underestimate him as far as releasing this material?
Mm-hmm.
I think
he's
going to do it.
Do you think this is part of the acclimation or soft disclosure?
I think it is. I think most people now kind of realize that if you're talking about UFOs or anything like that, people don't think it's nearly as weird as they used to.
Yeah.
And I remember even before Roger Lear passed away, we talked about that, and he said most people now believe that it's a big universe and there's stuff going on that we don't know about, and beyond that, even that there's top secret projects that we're developing that are basically breaking physical boundaries as far as what can be done with a craft. And, you know, it's very difficult to tell how much of it's true and how much of it is hearsay, and we don't have any actual physical proof. But we know that this stuff is going on because people are seeing it all over the world in increasing numbers. So
yeah, and photographing it too.
There. Yeah, everybody's got HD cameras on their cell phones now. And while that's good, there's cell phones also create all sorts of weird anomalies at times. So, yeah, I mean, it's just... So,
yeah.
You know, lens flares and internal reflections and all sorts of stuff in the shot, and then people think, oh, it's another Nibiru, or, you know, it's like, I've looked at this stuff, and I'm going, guys, it's obviously an internal reflection. I mean, if you can tell that's what it is, but you can't convince these people of that.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful in analyzing that photography.
With all the research that Lear did, Dr. Lear, what was his conclusion as to whether they were alien or whether they were just advanced technology we already have and probably military in its nature? Did he ever say?
Well, when you get the best of watchers, UFO.
Mm-hmm. You're breaking up.
Clearly, can you hear me now?
Yep.
You can clearly see alien beings on the ship. I mean, you can see their eyes and turning their heads, and you know, it's not like it's super high res because this craft was about a mile away from the camera, and the camera was zoomed in and had a extender on the lens, and it was standard def NTSC shot in 2009. If it happened today, it would be there with much better cameras and could really see even more. But if you get the best of watchers, you can see that, and it's very convincing. And the only reason I did it was because before Roger passed away, he said that there was this guy from Chile who did an analysis of the occupants of the craft, and I looked it up and found his website, and sure enough, he had still images and short bursts of GIF images where you could see something through the portal on one side of the ship, and
mm-hmm.
it looked like little gray aliens with the big eyes, you know,
yep.
and then some other being next to it that looked like a big praying mantis kind of creature. Now, I know how unlikely that sounds, but in our research on alien abduction, which has happened all over the world, not just here
mm-hmm.
in the States, but all over the world, Moscow and Israel and every place, people have talked about being abducted and ended up on a ship and had missing time and saw these things. Typically what happens, you've got a couple of these little gray aliens, and then you've got this bigger guy that looks like a praying mantis who's supervising the procedure. And that's what was aboard the Converness craft, with two little grays and one larger creature.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting, Richard, that you found also that the activity going on inside the craft itself was speeded. In other words, it was a lot quicker than time outside the craft.
Yeah, we think it could be a great example of time dilation, where we know that from what I've learned, that gravity, if you're going to create a ship that can levitate and defy gravity, you're warping time at the same moment, because gravity and time are tied together. So we constantly hear people say that they've had missing time when they've been aboard a craft. I mean, that's a common occurrence. It's happened time and time again where people say they were taken aboard a craft and they got home 5 hours later than they expected to be. Even if you get near a craft and you don't even go in it, if you enter the ship's gravity envelope, so to speak, it's kind of like a toroidal core of the lines flux that are going around the ship that create this gravity field. If you get too close to that, then you become part of their time-space system. And you don't realize that it's happening.
Yeah, Larry had a friend that he knows down there that got close to a ship. Actually, I've got a picture of it, and Larry does. Larry, didn't he say something about he felt different, or maybe there was a time warp or something there? You remember that?
Yeah, he said he said the closer he got to the ship, he felt like he was slowing down. Things were changing around him. It made him fearful, and he said he thinks it took longer to get back to the house than it took to get down to the ship. He said something about time was really weird.
Well, if time is running like 10 times normal speed on the ship, but if you're there experiencing it, it wouldn't seem like that to you. It would seem normal. But everything else would be in a different time-space continuum than what you're experiencing. So when you leave the ship, you'd be 5 or 6 hours later because of the difference in time. And so when I slowed down the video of what we were seeing inside that ship, you could see the motion much more clearly. And had that camera had the ability to shoot, 240 frames a second, we could have seen a lot more than what we actually saw. It just wasn't the equipment available to do that, and no one's financing stuff like that. I mean, here they are out, doing, with radio telescopes trying to get signals from space. We have ships that are flying over all the time, and no one cares. It's just unbelievable to me. Like, it seems so stupid. Like, why don't we just get some really great cameras with telephoto lenses that can shoot, 240 frames a second and go take some pictures and see what we can discover? But no one does that.
It could be the same thing that NASA does. They've got their little space program that's for public consumption. And then they have their top secret space military program, which is secret. And maybe this is exactly what's going on with the UFO and NASA, or the NSA, rather, acclimation project, where they feel mankind's not ready yet. So they put up all this search for, like SETI and all that, when they know perfectly well that we've already had contact.
Yeah, SETI, Roger used to call it, he said SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate.
Okay.
Because
what was
like,
his take on the UFO? arrival?
Oh, well, Roger passed away in March of 2014, but he never saw the movie, The Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about, I mean, when you pull alien implants out of people's body and you do EDX analysis and electron microscopy on it, and you basically are looking at essentially the periodic table of elements that's present in that sample, and they all come up with the same information, that it's the same percentage of nickel and iron and sometimes titanium that you would find in a meteoric particle, then that is not something that is naturally occurring. And also another thing that happened is that most of the time that people have these things in their body under the skin, there's, as Roger would say, there was no portal of entry. And what he meant by that is that there's no scarring or anything where you have even the slightest idea of where this thing could be under the skin. You have to x-ray it to find it. Or you can use like a stud finder. That's another thing, because it's a metallic object, and it's like if you, you know, you can move a stud finder across your skin till you get to the spot where this implant is, and it'll go off. I've seen it happen. And it was in Watcher 7 and 8. In fact, in The Best of Watchers, I combined that whole story, so you don't have to go to two discs now. You can watch the whole alien implant discovery and removal in one big piece. And it's very scientific, and it was all done in completely lab conditions. And, you know, I don't know how someone can watch that and not be convinced that this is real. I don't know what else we could have done. We did x-rays until we found the object, and then when we knew where it was, Roger said we needed to do a CAT scan, so we paid to have a CAT scan done of Bill's leg, came up in the CAT scan, and then we realized it was like 1.5 centimeters from the top of the skin. It was about 6 millimeters long and about the thickness of a pencil lead, and it wasn't just a straight piece of wire or anything like that. It was a slightly miniaturized boomerang-shaped piece of very crystallized iron.
Wow.
And it was inside of a like a coating, which all these implants exhibit. There's like a protective coating around them that keeps the implant from creating any sort of infection or inflammation in the body. And that coating is sometimes hard to cut, but in the case of the last one we pulled out, Steve Colburn used a scalpel, and I got right on it with my camera, and he slipped the coating and out poured this little implant, along with kind of like a gooey substance, sort of amber-colored substance that it was floating in. And so the material that was coating the implant was sent to a pathology lab for testing. And I never got the actual paperwork from that because Roger passed away, but Roger and I did talk about it. I said, so what did they say? And he said, there was no sign of any kind of infection or inflammation present in the coating that was surrounding the implant. It had basically protected the implant from irritating the skin, the tissue,
mm-hmm.
where it was located. But we did find nerve fibers that were attached that had gone through the coating and into the actual implant, and the implant was sending signals out and receiving signals from somewhere. And
no, let
those
me ask you a
fibers,
question.
Sure.
If the alien or fallen angels, most likely, are the ones doing this, and it's not something that we've developed ourselves, would then the Illuminati or the powers that be take that technology for the mark and demand everybody get implanted?
I think it's beyond our technology. And the reason I say that is because both Steve and Roger believed that there was nanotechnology going on. And this is, you're talking at the atomic level here.
Mm-hmm.
So if these tiny little chips, these little devices that look nothing more than an irregular shaped piece of rock, or, you know, in this case, a tiny little boomerang shaped piece of crystallized metal, essentially they appear to have some sort of computer built into them. It's beyond our capability. And the other thing is, and I asked Steve this, I said, so you're telling me that we've got semiconductive nanoparticles, you know, nanostrands and nanospheres. You know, you can have conductive nanoparticles and non-conductive nanoparticles, just the same way that you would build an integrated circuit using silicon, right?
Right.
And they can do it with this at the atomic level, but that means that they have to connect those things into a working circuit. And what appears to be what is going on in these implants is that this is a three-dimensional circuit. It would be like a web of these components that are all impregnated in this nickel iron composite. And I said, well, how are they doing that? Because it would seem to me it would just short the whole thing out instantly. But he said, what seems to be happening is that same coating, that coating the whole thing on the outside, is also insulating these components on the inside. And it doesn't seem like there's any kind of, you know, they're not heating this to get all of those components in there. They're using some other method to move those elements into a metal substrate and then putting that into someone's body. That's way beyond our technology right now.
Well, Richard, didn't you also say that they actually transmit a frequency?
They do, yeah. I don't know if it's 330 megahertz or 330 gigahertz. Roger thought it was in the gigahertz range. But I've talked to two scientists about that, saying, well, then you're into microwaves, and that would actually cook the skin.
Huh.
But I'm really not sure if the reading that Roger got was in megahertz or gigahertz. But, yes, it was. He put a frequency counter up to it with an antenna, and it was sending out a signal. And as soon as you remove it, it goes dead. It's no longer connected to nerve ending. And the other thing is, it's sending out a magnetic flux density in the, basically, it was sending out almost 7 milligauss. And he measured my camera, and it's in the film. People have seen this. And my camera, with a lithium-ion battery, and it was a Canon camera that I was using to record all this. And it was reading 10 milligauss with a fully charged lithium-ion battery. And this little implant, 6 millimeters in length, was putting out 7 milligauss with no battery or anything connected to it. And it was
that is high tech.
It's very, very high tech. And
yeah.
I don't think it, just to say that we're just using blockchain and we want to have an RFID chip give us our token number so we can get into our account, you wouldn't need anything super sophisticated to do that. But if it gets really dark and evil, and if they are able to transmit a signal and have the chip emit some sort of toxic substance into your bloodstream or to try to kill you remotely, you know what I'm saying? None of this would surprise me. None of this is really that kind of thing. We know how to kill people pretty well nowadays.
Yeah.
So nothing would surprise me that they would try to do something like that to keep people in line. And all this goes clear back to the Ron Wyatt account of his deathbed confession of the Ark of the Covenant. And he said he saw angels down in this chamber underneath the Temple Mount when he saw it in 1982. And he said no one would be able to find the Ark again until it's time for the Mark of the Beast. Now, that's what he says. That's what he said in his deathbed confession.
Well, it seems like we're getting awful close to that. I mean, with the Bitcoin experiment going on and everything else and the technology.
What's your
take on this arrival thing? With all this release suddenly, it seems to me it's right on time for the 2017-2018 pivot that maybe the arrival's not very far off.
Well, I have a bit of difference of opinion when it comes to L.A. Marzulli on aliens. I mean, his take is they're all fallen angels, they're all evil. I tend to not agree with that. And I said, here's my argument against just saying it's all bad, is because there's supposed to be, in Scripture it talks about, if we're going to use the Bible as a historical document here, that, you know, there's a war in heaven is going on.
Yes.
Well, how can you have a war unless there's two sides, a good and an evil side?
Mm-hmm.
And they're both angelic, if you want to call them that. And there's a very fine line, and a lot of people agree with me, that there's a very fine line between angels and aliens. If we saw an angel today, would we say it's an alien? If you saw like a 7-foot glowing being walking up towards you, would you call it an alien? I bet you probably would. Most people would, because of movies and the way we've been indoctrinated to believe that's what it is. And we haven't seen an angel, so we don't know what they actually look like. And, you know, I love Dr. David Jacobs, because he, in the Best of Watchers, he kind of makes fun of people who just won't come to grips with the whole idea that there's other life out there. And he said, years ago, it was like you could never say the word aliens, you know, so they were like humanoids, and then they were like, you know, this and that. And he said, but actually, they're aliens. He said, and I have trouble still saying the word aliens. But he's just great, and he's totally right. I mean, we've just got to say, okay, and we don't mean aliens from Mexico either. We're talking about space. People from
space beings,
and you know, and the thing that has always intrigued me so much was, and I've told you guys this before in other shows, but you know, I've done a lot of work with the rabbis on the Torah code, and early on, you know, I was talking with Rabbi Glazerson before I got to know him so well, and we were such good friends now. But, you know, we got to talking about the Tower of Babel, and he said, oh, yeah, the Tower of Babel. He said it was a landing platform for space vehicles. I mean, he just goes around and says that. And it's just this guy that looks like Elijah sitting in my studio telling me this. I'm like, oh, okay, now we're totally going down the rabbit hole here.
A minute left. How do they reach you?
Okay. Well, just to conclude that, it's like all of the rabbis feel that this is prophetic, that it has to happen before the Messiah returns.
Mm-hmm.
They're not at all.
How do they reach you?
By these things happening. Just go to my website, pinlight.com, P-I-N-L-I-G-H-T, and please order a Best of Watchers. It's 2 hours and 23 minutes long. It's the longest Watchers to date. And it's got all of the best segments, and it ends with the director's cut of the Howard Storm near-death experience, and it's incredibly powerful.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on, and thank you, Larry, for coming on, and we really appreciate it. I guess we have to close her down. And thanks for listening,
thanks,
everybody, and good night.
Thanks, guys.
Yep. Have a Merry Christmas, Richard.